QSO Today, episode 540, Al Rovner, K7AR. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of QSOtoday.com webpage. August is the anniversary of the first QSO Today Virtual Ham Expo. That is when I pay for the hosting of all of the content hosted on Vimeo and other platforms. I am working on moving over 400 videos to YouTube, where hosting is free. My greatest appreciation to you if you can help with your donations and sponsorships to keep all this stuff alive while I'm making the transfer. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. Just a reminder that the response to my amateur radio events calendar has been great. You can get to it from the banner link on the show notes page. This calendar is updated by you and is fast becoming the most comprehensive amateur radio events calendar on the internet. Please use it and update it with your ham radio events. I have been using Google Notebook LLM to keep my listing of all the podcast interviews, now 540 great one-hour ham radio interviews, easy to read and downloadable with links. Check this resource out on the QSOtoday.com website. Al Rovner, K7AR, discovered amateur radio in high school through his electronics shop teacher, an active ham who helped him earn his first license in 1971. After college and a break from the hobby, Al returned to the air in 1980 and soon found that working DX was far more interesting than working the States. This interest grew into decades of serious DXing, eventually taking him to the upper levels of the DXCC honor roll and sending him on DX expeditions around the world. Along the way, Al became an experienced contester and CW operator, while also embracing newer modes including FT8. More than 50 years after he began, the excitement of arriving somewhere new, putting up an antenna, and hearing the bands come alive still drives him. K7AR is my QSO today. K7AR, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Al?
4Z1UG, this is K7AR. Go ahead, over.
Al, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
I was first licensed in high school after seeing all the equipment that my electric shop teacher had in the shop. We had workbenches where we were taught basic electronics. We verified Ohm's law. We verified Watt's law. And in the corner was an amateur radio station. And I didn't know what it was at the time. The teacher found that I was interested in it and tutored me and what the equipment was. He made some contacts for me, and that really piqued my interest. After that, I got my license in my junior year in high school, which was 1971.
Oh, that's a very similar story to mine. Did you work on the, and one of the things we did in the electronic shop was we found a five-tube super heterodyne AM receiver, you know, at a swap meet or something, and we tore it down to the parts and then rebuilt it. Did you do something like that?
Yes, but that would have been in my junior or senior year. So the electronics instruction came in the form of a kit with various parts. And as you move through the third and fourth year of the program, you started building more complex items like a receiver and even a transmitter. And the transmitter came with warnings to only use one banana lead as an antenna or you could cause interference. So I took 100 banana leads and strung them all around the shop. And the teacher said he could hear my transmitter out in the parking lot. And he came in and he said, there's only one person I know who would do this. And of course, it was me. So, yes, we built more and more complex products. And that got me interested in my engineering career.
And what was the hometown?
This was in Westmont, New Jersey, in Haddon Township, which is just outside of Camden, New Jersey.
And you obviously got to electronics shop in the ninth grade for some reason. Was there some kind of electronic trigger in your childhood that caused you to have this interest?
Well, I've always been interested in radio, even as a young boy. And I had several transistor radios, and I found that I could hear a lot more stuff at night than I could during the day. And I asked my dad, why is this? And he told me he didn't know, but he noticed the same thing. Driving around in his car, he could pick up more stations at night. I was just always interested in that, even as a 8 or 9 or 10 year old, and really enjoyed it.
Amazing. So here you are in 4 years of electronics courses. You get your ham radio license as a junior in high school. Did you have friends in high school who also shared the interest?
No, I didn't know any of my classmates. I did know other local hams that invited me to a club. And everyone in the club was an electrical engineer from Drexel University in Philadelphia. And they steered me toward going to Drexel and getting my electrical engineering degree, which in retrospect was a great idea.
And so you're also strong in math and science as well?
In high school, we met with a guidance counselor who gave us various tests to determine what direction might we be good at after high school. And they told me I was off the charts in science and math and would be a good candidate for engineering. So I had kind of two or three people pointing me in that direction.
Amazing. When you got out of Drexel, you had the BSCE, I guess. Did you go on to do further academic work in engineering?
Yes, but not for, let's see, I would have been 23, probably not for 12 or 13 years. Here in the Oregon area, I went back for a master's degree in computer science because my employer at the time, the famous company Tektronix, asked me to do a database development to characterize our manufacturing process. And I told my manager I really didn't know anything about databases. And he sent me to a class at the local college, and I liked it so much, I asked if I could continue to go to school. He said, sure. And that wound up being a three-year project where I finally got my master's degree.
And you were able to solve the problem that Tektronix was having.
Yep.
How about that? What was your first rig before we move on a little bit?
My very first rig was a homebrew transmitter I built from I believe it was the 1969 ARRL handbook, a crystal controlled 6146 output final. And of course, we were limited to 75 watts input. So that was my very first transmitter, which I only used for, I don't know, 6 months or 9 months. And I was able to scrape up enough money to buy a used Hallicrafters HT32A. That thing was big and heavy.
That was the transmitter. What was the receiver?
When I first started, I had the old realistic DX150, which, by the way, I was also a shortwave listener before I was a ham. Mm-hmm. I continued to use that radio until I found it was not particularly good at ham use. And I wound up getting a Drake 2B, which even today I still like. I always thought that was a good receiver.
Do you still own the Drake 2B?
Unfortunately, no. Ever since. So when I started at Drexel, honestly, I had no time for ham use. I was incredibly busy. I sold all my equipment, and I didn't get back into ham gear until 1980, when I had moved to Southern California, and all my coworkers were hams, and they urged me to get back in the hobby, which I did then.
And so in 1980, you were living in the Los Angeles area?
Orange County. I lived in Santa Ana, and I worked in Anaheim.
Really? Who did you work for in Anaheim?
A small company called Interstate Electronics Corporation that was doing development of one of the very first GPS receivers ever.
Mm-hmm.
And we were required to be in the lab whenever we had view of the one or two satellites that were present at that time. So if the satellite was in view at 3 a.m, we had to be in the lab at 3 a.m. And I later worked for Northrop in the defense industry, also in Anaheim.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you remember any of the hams there at Interstate?
Vaguely. I mean, this was 45 years ago. I remember some of them. What I remember about Northrop is they had a separate building in the parking lot for a ham radio club, and they had towers out back. And I could get on whenever I wanted. I used to go out there and eat my lunch in the shack and get on the air and work stuff. And this was a much better station than I had in my little apartment in Santa Ana.
Amazing. Well, I actually lived in that area at that time. So I was just kind of, you know, curious if there was anybody that you might know there. Okay, well, that's very interesting. So you get back into the hobby in 1980. What caused that interest in working DX?
Well, to be honest, I was kind of bored working U.S. State. I didn't find it that inspiring to contact Texas or Nebraska or something like that. I wanted to see, well, how far can I work? And keep in mind, in Santa Ana, all I had, I lived in an apartment, and I went to my landlord, and I didn't ask. I basically made a statement that I want to put up this antenna, and I showed them a picture of a Hustler vertical. And the landlord went, well, okay, as long as it doesn't go above the roof. And so I stuck up this vertical antenna that was like 23 feet tall, and it went right up to the roof line. The problem, while that worked and I could get on the air and I could even work DX, I caused a lot of interference to nearby apartment people, TVs, stereos, whatever. You know, my antenna was only just feet from their television. So I don't know, I kind of had to limit my hours to not be too much of a burden.
I see, because the antenna was kind of ground-mounted. It wasn't on the roof.
That's correct.
Right. Oh, that makes sense. It's a funny thing. You know, being in Israel, I'm kind of tired of working Europe, frankly, because they're on every band. Europe is wide open during the day. And it's kind of like, boy, I would like to work the United States or South America.
I have a related story. I had the opportunity to go on a de-expedition to Syria on two different occasions in 1994 and 1990. And, excuse me, 1994 and 2001. And needless to say, the Europeans are very loud, 20, 30 over 9. We had very limited openings to the West Coast and so forth. I was trying to work North American stations, and let's just say it was difficult. There was not a lot of cooperation.
Yeah, so I'm playing with FT8 right now. It seems to be the best mode for checking to see which direction my inverted V seems to work on various bands. And occasionally, I've worked a few North Americans, but not many, and I don't think I've worked any West Coast at this point. So you were saying you got bored with working North America and you decided to start working DX. What kind of dedication did it take to become, you know, a real DXer? And how did you improve your craft over the years?
Well, you need to be available when the DX is available. You need to know what the expeditions are planned, what dates will they be on, what bands will they favor, and so forth. Now, back then in the 80s and 90s, we had newsletters like the Daily DX and others. They were helpful, but of course, there was no real-time feedback as to this station is on this frequency right now. So I consulted the newsletters and tried to keep up to date with all the news as to who was going to be on, and I made myself available. And what I found was my little vertical antenna was okay for working the Pacific and Asia, but getting into Europe and Africa was a little bit harder. And I started thinking about moving. And I had several interviews. I had an interview in Austin, Texas, had an interview in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I had an interview with Tektronix here in Vancouver, Washington. And that interview in Vancouver worked out great. Half the people I worked with were hams. I fit right in. It was right up my alley, writing a firmware to designing electrical systems, writing the firmware to drive it. And I wound up moving here at the end of 1984.
Were you able to find a QTH that lent itself well for being a DXer?
It's the same QTH I'm in now. I've lived here for 41 years. All the homes in my neighborhood are on 1 acre lots. And out in my back half acre, I have a 75-foot Rhone 45 tower with a big stepper GB36 on it. And I'm not entirely sure of this, but I don't believe that I need a building permit to put that tower up. No one has ever said anything. The county has never come knocking on my door. So I went from having this little vertical to having a real antenna and a little bit of land where I could put up some wire inverted L's and quarter wave slopers and so forth.
Now you've got the QTH and you've got the antennas that you need in order to work DX. When you say being available, are you saying that that also means getting up in the middle of the night, if, following the gray line, perhaps, in order to be there for these openings?
Absolutely true. When I was chasing DX, I was up. Let me restart that. When I was chasing DX on 80 and 75 meters, I was here at every sunrise and every sunset, all season long for probably 10 years.
But being a young man, you didn't need a nap in the middle of the day.
That's true. What I found on 75 meters was there's a pecking order. You got guys with 80-meter Yagis running kilowatts that can work any station they want to work. And here I am with my quarter-wave sloper. And the stations would go, anyone else like a contact with 4Z1 United Golf? And I'd throw in my call, and they go, go ahead, Al. And I'd call you. And one of the big guys would go over, and I would say, I'm sorry, I didn't hear him. Can we try again? And they'll say, call again, Al. So I try again, and maybe on the second or third time, I could hear you and give you a report. But they were nice enough to let us little guys in on 75. That's probably one of my weakest bands as far as antennas.
Fascinating. Okay, so then what did it take to reach the DXCC number one spot? How long did that take, and what kind of dedication did that take?
Well, before you get to number one, you have to get on the start of the honor roll, which is what, nine countries from the top, I believe. So the current top is 340. So that would mean you have to get to 331 to get to be on the basic honor roll. And it's just a matter of commitment. knowing who was on, being available in the middle of the night, calling before FT8, I would be on CW, and it might take me 2 to 3 hours of calling to get through a pileup, but I did. It's just dedication, just getting on all the time, looking for the expeditions, especially new ones, that I need this country, I need that country. Well, today we call them entities.
DX entities. Did you get North Korea?
I have two contacts with North Korea. The first one was kind of odd. This station was calling CQ on 10 meter sideband with no one coming back to him. He was just CQing. And I was so surprised. I called him barefoot with the 100 watts. He comes right back to me. And I talked with him for 2 or 3 minutes. And I said, stay here. I'll announce you on the DX cluster and more people will call you. So I put him out on the cluster. And a handful of stations from the Pacific Northwest worked him. And then propagation went away. There was the so-called flashlight propagation to the Pacific Northwest. And he only worked a handful of stations. And luckily, I was one of them. The same station was on later on 20 meter RIDI. He was 20 over S9 at my location, and I can't print him. And I'm pulling out the rest of my hair trying to figure out why I can't print him. And on the DX cluster, it says he's transmitting at 50 baud, which is not normal. So now I'm going through this software. Where the heck do I change my baud rate? So I found it. I changed it to 45 baud, which is normal. And then I started printing him, and I got through right away. That was, I think that was in 2004. And so I haven't seen or heard North Korea in 22 years.
And now this mid-show break. The QSO Today project now has over 500 podcast episodes and hundreds of hours of virtual ham radio expo presentations, all freely available and fully supported by you, the listener. This short message and the later mention of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast are the only breaks in the program. QSO Today has no commercial sponsors, so no one influences the content or direction. This project exists solely to promote amateur radio and the people who make it thrive. Producing QSO Today is like a half-time job. Your support at any level covers the tools, hosting, and production costs that keep it going. And while it is a labor of love, it isn't free. Only about 6% of listeners contribute. Please consider making a donation. Use the slider on our donations page to set up the amount that reflects the value that you get from each episode or from our library of educational videos. Make it monthly to help secure the next 500 episodes. You can also become a listener sponsor, shop on Amazon using our referral link, share QSO Today with friends, subscribe to our mailing list and YouTube channel, and help spread the word. Every action is value for value. Keep QSO Today alive by taking action now. We return to our QSO. Besides North Korea, what is the other, say, two countries that are the most difficult to get?
A lot of these ones, like Bouvet, where it takes a huge effort to go there, like Kerguelen Islands, Bouvet, South Georgia, South Sandwich. It takes a big ship and a lot of money and 20 operators. The good news is you can usually work them. I believe it was 5 contacts with the recent operation from Bouvet. I almost got them on 160. I was trying so hard to get them on 160. But all I would get was on FT8, I would decode a packet here and there, but not quite enough for a whole QSO.
Do awards such as DXCC improve your operating skills? Or can award chasing sometimes distract from the larger purpose of amateur radio?
I feel it does improve your operating skills. Learning where to call in a pileup, looking for open spots, open frequencies. And what really improves your operating skill is going on a de-expedition. How well can you handle a pileup when you're now on the receiving end of it?
Was that the reason that you started going on de-expeditions?
Not really. I went on my first expedition in 1987. I was talking on 20-meter sideband to Kilo Hotel Zero Alpha Charlie, who's now a silent key. And I told him where I was located, and he said, oh, I'm from Camas. And you wouldn't know this, but Camas is the next city over for me, 2 or 3 miles away. So we had a very nice chat about how he wound up as an administrator for the local university on Saipan. And then he invited me to, he said, would you like to come out and operate for the CQ Worldwide Sideband Contest? And it took me 2 nanoseconds to hit the push the talk button on the mic and say, yes, I'm coming.
So that's great. So that was your first de-expedition?
That was my first one, and I had a ball. I just loved it. And I couldn't wait to go out on my next one. My next expedition, I convinced my manager at Tektronix to send me to Guernsey Island, where Tektronix has a plant. They have a manufacturing plant. And I went there to install new equipment and train the local people how to use it and what to do. And while I was there, I arranged to stay at a bed and breakfast run by a local ham. And he said, you have complete access to my equipment 24 hours a day. Have fun. That, oh, and again, that was, again, and I couldn't wait to go out again.
That's pretty cool. When it comes to selecting a destination, how do you decide which destinations that you want to go to for your personal de-expeditions?
That's an interesting question. The last 12 or 13 years, I've been operating from the Pacific, sometimes by myself and sometimes with my friend Bob W7YAQ. And we found the Pacific Islands can be in high demand simply because they're very far away from places like your area and Western Europe. It can be hard to work the Central Pacific from the UK, Spain, Portugal, and so forth. So the Pacific Islands, we've had very good pileups from. Where else have I gone? I've been to Central America. I've been all over the Caribbean. I'm going back to Bermuda at the end of September with a couple of my buddies. And the reason we're going to Bermuda is because we could get relatively cheap flights. The flights to the Pacific were costing over $3,000 US. And we all decided that, no, we don't want to spend that kind of money. So it's just a matter of, you know, has this island been active lately? No, it hasn't been active for 7 or 8 years. Well, that might be a good place to go.
Have you ever arrived at a destination to discover that the site, the noise level, the power system, or the antenna space was very different from what was promised? And what did you do?
Not really. One of the things, if you're going to go on an expedition and you're going to stay at a hotel or a resort, you need to ask the owner for permission. Like, I would like to, I'm an amateur radio operator. I would like to visit your location and install a temporary antenna system. And the key word there is temporary. When I leave, I'm going to take everything down and you won't even know I was there. And I've never been turned down. No one has ever said, no, you can't do that.
And are these antennas on the building itself or out on the beach or?
No, I've never placed an antenna on the building. What you're looking for is a location where you can put your antenna on the beach as close to the water as you can get it. When we were in Vanuatu, my friend Bob and I, our antennas were like 2 feet from the ocean. Okay. and magic happens. When you get your antenna near the salt water, magic happens, even with a simple, like a DX Commander vertical antenna. Boy, that just works the world from there.
What was the most serious technical or logistical problem that you faced during a de-expedition?
Well, if I go back to Syria, one day we were visited by someone for the 2001 trip. I was the team leader. And we were visited by someone. We operated from their main telephone building. We had antennas all over the roof of their telephone building. Someone came in and said, "You're causing interference to our equipment." And I knew right away what that meant. That meant stop now. So I asked the operators to turn off their amplifiers and run 100 watts. And I asked the gentleman, "Can you please check again and see if the interference is still present?" And he came back later and he says, "No, okay now, the interference is gone." So we kind of came up with an informal agreement. We'll use our amplifiers outside of business hours and we'll run barefoot during business hours. And that seemed to work out okay. But you have to be flexible, knowing that the results could be you could be ejected from the country at that point.
Right. Sound to me like you didn't seem to have any problems in this particular case where you came across someone who might have been hostile to you, either as an amateur radio operator or to you as an American.
True. In Vanuatu, all of our radio gear was confiscated and locked up by the Customs Department. We tried for a half hour to explain why we were there. We were there for our hobby. We wanted to talk with other hobbyists around the world, and that when we would leave, we would bring all of our equipment with us. We would not leave anything behind or sell it. And that went nowhere. And I had sent an email to Bernie, W3UR, saying that we were going to be delayed because our equipment was locked up. And I received an email the next day from a gentleman in the UK who used to be the customs manager at Vanuatu. And he said, "Go back to them and mention my name and tell them I said it was okay to release your equipment." So the next day we went back and talked with the manager and he said, "Yes, oh, I remember him, sure." But there was still questions about what is this equipment? Did you pay taxes on it? Well, we don't need to pay taxes on it. We're not leaving it here. We're bringing everything home with us. And after some discussion, they finally released our gear and we lost a day or a day and a half of operating, but that's how it goes.
What's your present flyaway station? What are you going to take with you on your next de-expedition?
My previous flyaway station was all the Elecraft gear, which added up to almost 40 pounds of carry-on gear. Luckily, it was small and didn't look suspicious, but that was heavy. A KPA 500 weighs 26 pounds, and I'm a short person, and I'm lifting a 26-pound weight, trying to put it in the overhead bin on an airplane, and I can't reach it. So I asked some of the other passengers to help me, and they go, "What do you have in here, gold bars?" And they said the same thing, "But that's heavy." So my new setup is the Flex Aurora 510. That's the low-end model with no front panel. However, it's still fairly large. It's 7 inches tall, and I'm trying to come up with some kind of travel case for it. But that only weighs 18 pounds. So I'm cutting my travel weight pretty much in half or less. And I'm looking for, I haven't been on an expedition with the Aurora yet, but I'm looking forward to that.
Right. And so the Aurora, just for the listeners who haven't been read in yet, is Flex Radio's new 500-watt using what polar modulation or something like that in order to be able to make that 500 watts?
Correct. One of the things I really like about the Aurora is it doesn't get hot. You can run it at 500 watts all day long and it barely breaks a sweat. And I think that's because it's so efficient. On the 120 volt AC line, it only draws 6 amps to put out 500 watts RF. So it's just so efficient. It doesn't get hot at all.
That's pretty amazing. And does it have a switch for 220? I mean, if you're traveling into Europe or any place other than Japan and Canada, you're going to be faced with 220 volts.
That's correct. It's all automatic. I think it does 100 to 250 volts or something, automatic switching. By the way, you brought up a good point. If you're going to go on a trip somewhere, you need to research what kind of power outlets do they use? What's the AC line voltage? What adapters do I need? You need to do that well in advance or you could be surprised.
Yeah, what I do is I actually get the from an electric supply, you can do it now on the internet, from an electric supply store in the country you're going to, just get the male plug and put it on the end of your, I actually put it on a Euro plug, which is the standard 3 thing that plugs into most gear now. And I have the female Euros. And so I make an adapter, a pigtail with the local male plug to the Euro female. And then I bring my own power strips that hold all of my chargers and everything like that when I'm traveling. And that seems to work. And you can get that stuff. And those work better than adapters. I think they're probably, it's more efficient. So you're not, you don't have a lot of heat at the adapter itself.
That's a good point. Yeah, sure.
So you can buy a lot of, you can buy the British, well, you might even be able to find it in maybe in supplies. Oh, Alibaba. So I'll give you, I've done that, AliExpress and Temu. I've found those plugs, in there as well. So just for an aside.
I do a talk on going on your first D expedition. And just a lot of little things you pick up that you wouldn't think of, like bring an extension cord with you. Little dumb things like that.
Those are things that items that you would check. You want to carry the rig with you, in the overhead compartment. But things like antennas and wire and balun and coax and stuff, where do those ride?
Well, I usually travel with a 4-foot-long golf case. And in the golf case, I have a DX Commander antenna and a spider pole for a 160-meter antenna, and all the various wires, radio wires. I travel in with these 1-gallon plastic bags, and I roll up a lot of the wire, and I stick it in the plastic bags. That all goes in the golf case, which if you're going to go on an expedition like this, get ready to pay excess baggage fees or oversized baggage fees. It's just part of the game.
Right, and it's good to have that stuff. What convinced you that FT8 should be part of a serious de-expedition?
I happen to like FT8 a lot. Earlier, I said that I like to go places that are difficult for people to work, like for Western Europe to work the South Pacific. A lot of these stations are very modest. They don't have towers, Yagis, and kilowatts. FT8 is incredibly good at digging out weak stations out of the noise. I've done some tests here at home where I said, there's nothing there. All I hear is noise. There's nothing. Nope, wrong, completely wrong. The software is digging out minus 24 and minus 25 dB signals out of that. The other thing I like about FT8 as an operator is it's very non-stressful. After a 4 or 5 hour shift of operating CW, I'm ready to have a drink. It's pretty stressful. on FT8 running as a Fox, it's not stressful at all. It add operators to a queue. The software will work stations from the queue in the order you specify. And it's just very easy on the operator, where you could go all day long and not be tired. Now, of course, with this queue, you know, if I were to hear you in the queue, Eric, I could move you up to the very top, so you would be the next station contacted. And I only do that for special friends.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now, and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. What's the difference between ordinary FT8 operation and Fox and Hound operation?
My very first use of FT8 was on an expedition to Samoa as 5W0RA. I had never used the software. I didn't know anything about it. It was all brand new. And I was lucky enough to have a tutor, my friend Atsu, 5W1SA, who's on the air almost every day. He came over and tutored me into how to make contacts. And my first impression was, it works. I can make contacts, but it's very slow. I'm used to working 300 to 400 contacts per hour. And with regular FT8, I can work 50 to 60. And then if there are retries involved, then it gets even slower. That was in 2017. The next year, 2018, the developers released de-expedition mode, which is what we call Fox Hound mode. As a Fox, I can work 3 or 4 stations at once, and I can get my QSO rate easily in the 200 to 300 an hour or higher. And then recently, in the last couple years, they've released Super Fox mode, where you could probably do over 400 QSOs an hour, which for someone like Bouvet, that would be wonderful. That's what they need in Bouvet and some of these really rare locations. So Super Fox allows you to send, I hope I get this correct, 4 signal reports and 5 RR73 reports in 1 15-second cycle. And really, that's quite impressive.
Now, do you try on it when you do your de-expeditions from a hotel or whatever? Do you try to run multiple modes, not just FT8, but single sideband, CW, RTTY, and FT8 in order to create a variety of offerings for the people that are wanting to pounce on you and be able to give everybody a chance to work you?
Yes, I do. However, I prefer CW. I like to think of myself as a reasonably good CW operator. I'll get on sideband, although I don't really like it that much because there's just so much chaos and confusion that's going on. And it takes me a long time to pull out one call sign when people don't cooperate or they keep calling or they can't hear me. So I prefer CW. I will do sideband. Typically, I only do RTTY during a contest. In September, A couple friends and I are going to Bermuda for the CQ Riddy contest. So we'll be running Riddy all weekend long from there.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's only during contests when you actually hear Riddy operation. I've kind of tuned around myself at various times and don't hear any Riddy operation at all, unless it's a contest. Does that's your
yes
experience as well?
Yes, that's true. I think Riddy has become, I don't know, people will probably disagree with me. I think it's become more of a nostalgic mode than a practical mode for expeditions to use.
Or for anybody to use it.
Yes.
You've written some articles for QST. I think the most recent one I think I saw was on networking and USB connectivity. How much networking knowledge should the average amateur radio operator have now in order to be able to put their station together effectively?
That's a great question. I think some basic knowledge is needed. What is Ethernet? What are IP addresses? How does my home router work? What do I do if I want to access my station remotely? What is port forwarding? Okay. Just kind of just some basic knowledge of networking will go a long way. Speaking of remoting, I had the chance over our July 4th holiday weekend to use my Flex Aurora remotely, and I was super impressed with it. It's so easy to use that from a remote location. They've got it all designed in. It's just wonderful. I'm very pleased with it.
Now, does Flex, as a Flex radio owner, do they have an owner's club that essentially allows you to connect to other Flex stations in the owner's group?
Not to my knowledge, but I'm so new at this, I could be wrong. There's nothing that stops a friend of yours from accessing your station as long as they have the correct software and know the process. I mean, there's certainly you could let a friend use your station.
Do you think that we're becoming too dependent on computers, drivers, internet connections, et cetera, when working amateur radio these days?
Perhaps. The bottom line is we're still using RF and antennas and coax to make contacts. And I've been on islands where I have no internet access. So I'm not able to upload my logs to Club Log every day. So, right there, you've just got your radio and your coax and your logging computer, and that's it.
Well, it's my understanding that you could probably buy a Tesla cell phone now and go to just about any place in the world and operate the cell phone over Starlink or take a Starlink terminal. Are you considering taking any gear like that on future de-expeditions so that you always have the internet connection?
Not really. It would just be extra gear and extra weight and cost that I would need to deal with. I think that's important for very rare locations. So they can communicate with their pilot stations, so they can upload their logs. The Club Log has become a very important factor in a lot of expeditions to give people that warm feeling that, yes, I really am in the log. Thank you. So I do an annual donation to Club Log every year.
You're a member, I think, of the Willamette Valley DX Club. What value as a DXer has being a member of this club contributed to your amateur radio experience?
I need to teach you how to pronounce that word, Eric.
Okay, I'm ready.
It's Willamette.
Willamette. Willamette Valley DX Club.
The Willamette Valley DX Club is a club here in the Portland, Oregon area, which I joined pretty much right after I moved here, some 40 years ago. And we have, I don't know, 70 or 75 members. And What I like about the club is these are active DXers. These are guys that are on the air every day. They're listening to 6 meters for European openings every day. They're chasing the expeditions every day. And we have email lists and so forth where we spot our own DX for club members to join in. So I really like the club. It's a wonderful group of people, very active, and it's just been a great asset to the local community.
If you're a listener to the QSO Today podcast and you're saying, you know, I think I'd like to become a DXer, DXpeditioner, do you think joining the local DX club has value in terms of being able to make that first step towards becoming a serious DXer?
Yes, it certainly does. You can get all kinds of tips. What kind of antenna can I use? When's a good time to get on the air? What kind of calling procedure do I need to work? How do I work split mode? All these kind of questions any DX club could help new people with.
After more than 50 years in amateur radio, what part of the hobby still excites you the most?
I really enjoy the de-expedition part of it, and I would encourage people to go on their own trips. Even a simple trip, like let's just take a little side trip to Puerto Rico and put up a little wire antenna in the tree. You'd be surprised what you can work from there. After you go through, last November I went to Palau, and then I realized, you know, even from Honolulu to Palau is still 3,800 miles. You really get a feel for how big the Pacific Ocean is. But, you know, you get there and you get your antenna hooked up and you hook it up for the first time, and 20 meters just comes alive. You listen on 20 meters and the band is just full of stations. That gets me excited on every trip I go on.
That's really cool. Are rising travel costs, licensing restrictions, and environmental rules making future de-expeditions more difficult?
Yes. Earlier, I had said that we wanted to go to the Pacific, but the flight cost was exceeding $3,000, and that's just for a simple trip. So all these guys that have to rent a large ship and spend $1 million to go to an island, I think it just requires a lot of contributions from the community to support that and help them pay their costs. I'm lucky that the trips that I go on, licensing is usually very straightforward. If you wanted to go to French Polynesia, licensing is done strictly by email, and there's no cost involved. And they'll send you your license as a PDF file in email. Very simple, very easy for anyone to do that. And again, I would encourage people to go on their own trips.
Now, if you're a young person who has never printed a piece of paper, would you encourage anyone who's traveling on a de-expedition to one of these islands where you've received the license in PDF format, would you encourage them to bring a notebook full of paper that shows the licenses and all the permits and everything else? Or is showing your phone enough?
One of my rules is that I always print off my license and any import documents they may have provided, as I may need to show that to the customs inspector. And that has happened on numerous occasions, where I show them my license and say, I have a permit from your government to bring this equipment in the country. By the way, a lot of licenses, like French Polynesia, you have to include what equipment are you bringing? What's the model number? What's the serial number? What frequencies does it operate on? How much power are you running? And all that's printed on your license, okay? And it's pretty hard for the customs inspector to look at that and give you trouble at that point, because clearly I have permission from your government. So I always print that off and take it with me. That's one of my hard rules.
Yeah, that's very important. If you look back, Al, on your amateur radio life, what has amateur radio added to your life that you would not have found anywhere else?
Well, I've made a lot of friends around the world. I've traveled to a lot of destinations that I likely would never have gone to before. I probably would have never gone to Syria. I probably would have not gone to various Pacific islands. And I found my trips to the Pacific Islands has been very rewarding. I've learned a lot about their culture and their history that, I mean, had I not gone on these expeditions, I would have no idea at all.
So it's made you a world traveler.
Yes.
Yeah, certainly. I think certainly that one of the things that you mentioned that we share is we're a worldwide fraternity, and that those relationships and friendships supersede politics and everything else, I think. That's been my experience.
That's true. If you go on a trip and you forgot to bring your 12-volt power supply, a local ham will likely glad you let you borrow his 12-volt power supply. Just things like that. When I operated from Guernsey, the owner of the station gave me complete access to his station. You could use anything, any time of day you want, and that's how fraternal we are as hams.
I think, especially if you've been in ham radio for a while and you have a license like the Extra, for example, then I think it gives you a certain credibility worldwide with other hams. They, I would think, seem to think that you actually have a certain amount of knowledge that, you know what you're doing if you're using their equipment, and they feel better about it.
Yes. And of course there's always the rule that, if you break it, you bought it.
That's right.
Well,
How about that? Al, is there any advice that you'd give to new returning hams to the hobby?
that's a good question. I think I could break it down into two words. Get active. Get on the air. Well, that's four words. Get on the air. L listen to what's out there. Get on FT8 and some of these digital modes. Try a new band. Like, as you said, I've been a ham a long time, but I don't have a lot of experience on 6 meters. I don't know when to listen. Not sure if my antenna is too high. When I go on an expedition and I go out for lunch, I'll leave the radio monitoring 6 meter FT8. And one time we came back from lunch and the screen was full of contacts from Japan. So I got on and called CQ and, stand back. They all called. Every call district from Japan was calling me.
I also leave my radio on FT8 on various bands, and it is interesting to see, what kind of comes across my screen. I also like these DX or these digital websites that are listening around the world for your signal, or you're listening around and reporting back into these sites, so you can actually hear, who hears you, or what are you hearing, and where they are. And this is really, without transmitting, this is actually quite, quite cool as well. What is that? If I can remember what the name of that website is.
It's, oh boy.
PSK Reporter.
That's it.
That's
Yes,
it.
PSK reporter.
PSK Reporter. Amazing site. And then I've also been playing with Whisper and, down at, a couple of watts. And that's quite amazing as well in terms of its worldwide coverage.
So what else about the expeditions? When you come home, you will have to deal with QSLing. You will get, depends on how rare your location is, you will get hundreds, possibly thousands of QSL requests. although with Logbook of the World today, a lot of that is semi-automated. But still, there's still a desire for paper cards out there.
So you still have paper cards yourself?
Absolutely.
And you know that I just mailed something to the States, and it was quite expensive. So mailing paper cards around the world can be very expensive. Do you have a budget for that set aside?
Well, if I'm mailing my own cards, yes. I don't do that often. So if it's just a few dollars here or there, that's not a problem. With my de-expedition cards, people will send me, it used to be just one green stamp or $1 bill. Now today, like if you wanted me to send you a card from my Palau trip, you would have to send two green stamps to cover the postage. Speaking of which, it's going up again this Sunday.
Wow. So what you're saying is it's over $2 to send a postcard. Now, are you actually sending it as a postcard, or are you putting it in an envelope?
No, it goes in an envelope. It's not $2. I I think it's $1.70, and it may go up to $1.80 or $1.90 this Sunday. So $2 just rounds it off, maybe covers the cost of an envelope.
Al, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. I've learned a lot, and I so appreciate speaking to you today.
Oh, I'm happy to help, Eric, and you make it very easy to chat with people.
With that, 73. That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Al. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in K7AR in the search box at the top of the page.